Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments surrounding COVID-19 and other things you don't want to catch this time of year. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Should probably start with political news because we've got one more proposed Trump appointment to discuss. He has, since the last time we talked, unveiled his pick to head the National Institutes of Health, which, as I understand it, the principal grant-making arm of government for funding research onto health topics. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is, among other things, co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration, which, to the best of my recollection, was a position paper put out very early in the pandemic, arguing that the old and the vulnerable should hunker down and everyone else should just let it rip. What do you think of this choice?
I think it's a terrible choice. I think it's a terrible choice because, one, he's an ideologue. Two, he's had no experience managing anything like the NIH. Three, he was wrong about most things in regards to the COVID pandemic. Not all things. He had some good points, but most of his points were wrong, especially what you were referring to, the Great Barrington Declaration. Those three things alone, I think, really mean he should not be in a position of this authority. He's a physician, but he doesn't practice medicine. To my knowledge, he hasn't practiced medicine after his training. He's also has a PhD in economics, and that is where his thrust has been. He is a member of the very conservative think tank at Stanford. That, of course, in and of itself does not mean he shouldn't be in a position of responsibility in the government. But the other factors I mentioned, I think, really mean he should not have this position.
What are you concerned that an ideologue would be able to do in that position, directing the National Institutes of Health?
Well, I think it goes back to the Great Barrington Declaration, because that, I think, was a very conservative approach to, when I say conservative, a right-wing approach to how to handle the pandemic early on. This I'm talking about in the spring and summer of 2020, spilling into 2021, when we were seeing 25,000 deaths a week at the height in 2020. To put that in perspective, we're now seeing 300 to 400 deaths per week from COVID. What he and his group espoused was that we should, quote, just let it rip. That is, let everybody get COVID, then everybody would have herd immunity, and that would result in the pandemic being over. This was done at a time when we did not understand how this virus behaved and how it behaved vis-a-vis our immune system. That is, we don't get permanent immunity, as all the people who've gotten COVID more than once know well. So it wouldn't have worked at all. And it was reflected a tremendous amount of hubris. That is, assuming that this virus would lead to herd immunity without even knowing any scientific data to support that conclusion. And if followed, it would have led to an enormous number of deaths that would have been unnecessary. Now, they didn't claim that everybody should just go out and let it rip. They said that people at higher risk, like older people, should not do it, be around other people. That is, they should be cloistered. This, of course, would be very problematic in how to do that, just logistically. A lot of older people live with younger people. Where were they to go? And that was one of the many problems with that kind of thinking. So that's what I mean when I say an ideologue. It's this idea that, not based upon any sound science, in the midst of a horrific time of a pandemic, that he and other people espoused.
Did the Great Barrington Declaration grapple at all with the logistical question of how you would handle so many people getting sick with a deadly illness at the same time? I mean, what I recall was one of the principal things animating the various tiers of lockdowns we went through was concern that hospitals would be overwhelmed, as indeed some were, and that in that case of healthcare resources being completely maxed out, a lot of people who could be saved with treatment would die for lack of it.
That's right. There was nobody. They didn't address how older people and people who were at higher risk because of a compromised immune system, for example, how they were to be cloistered, which was a shocking omission in their hypothesis. And you're right. The deaths that occurred from COVID early on were due to our lack of understanding as to how best to treat it, and the lack of resources to treat it. You pointed out about hospitals being overwhelmed. I have this indelible picture in my mind of hospitals in New York in the mid to late spring of 2020, where people were in the aisles, in the corridors. People were sharing ventilators. It was an impossible time to adequately care for people. And we've subsequently learned that when hospitals are stressed like this, the mortality rates go way up, not surprisingly. So we had to really preserve our healthcare system to take care of the sickest. And if we, quote, let it rip, as Bhattacharya and his ilk proposed, the consequences would have been horrific.
All right. That is, I guess, our weekly dose of politics. I wanted to get into a little bit more practical health before we go to questions from our listeners. We're just starting the season where cases of everything from the common cold to influenza to RSV to, in recent years, COVID tick up. I wanted to just kind of do a temperature check with you. What are you seeing in the publicly available data? What are you concerned about over the next couple months? And what should people be thinking about who are making plans to travel or to see family?
Well, it is a pleasure to continue to give good news in regards to your question. If we look specifically at SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, we remain at a low point. We are roughly where we were at the very lowest point last spring. We are much lower than we were at this time last year. And last year was not as bad as the preceding years. So we are really in a good point with COVID right now. The question is, how long will it last? The most recent data we have in terms of these subvariants of Omicron is that there's no real outstanding subvariant. The race is really between two, the XBB.1 that's been circulating for a long time now. It's still the leader in the horse race, but it's being challenged now by another variant that has been steadily increasing. And that's called XCC. And right now, they're pretty much neck and neck. The leader in the horse race is KP.3.1.1. I misspoke there. So it's KP.3.11 is the leader, but just neck and neck with XCC. The reason why this is important is because probably the next time we speak, XCC will be in the lead. It appears to be more transmissible. It doesn't seem to cause more severe disease, but just its increased transmissibility is going to likely allow it to win the race. What that translates to, though, Brian, I'm not sure. I don't think anybody's sure. Will it mean another spike after the immunity so many people gained from getting COVID in the late summer, early fall this year? I'm not sure. So right now, we're really in a good place with COVID. I don't think it's going to last, but I think that we're not going to have, at least I'm very hopeful, we're not going to have a really significant surge in the winter. We'll probably have a surge, but we shouldn't have a significant surge. Now, the other two major viruses that we pay a lot of attention to in the winter months are respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, and influenza. RSV is increasing around the country. It is increasing somewhat here, but not dramatically. So right now, it doesn't look like a bad RSV season. And we typically see RSV increasing quite a bit right after Thanksgiving. So we'll keep an eye on that, but nothing yet of significance. Influenza, we typically see starting to rise after Thanksgiving. So we should see it coming up in the next couple of weeks, I would imagine. And we have no idea what kind of influenza season we'll have, but we have some information from the Southern Hemisphere that went through their winter with influenza, that it wasn't a particularly bad influenza season, that the vaccines we're using this year match up very well with the strains of influenza that are circulating. So we should have a pretty good vaccine response for those people who get vaccinated. So right now, we're at a quiet time with these three major respiratory viruses, and we can only hope that this will continue longer. Thanksgiving, the holidays with all the travel, all the Christmas events, and other holiday events that occur, Christmas itself, and the New Year's, all of these things, of course, perturb the system. They're really great friends of these viruses in terms of allowing them to spread. So we will see it increase, but right now things look really good.
All right, let's move to questions from our audience. If you want to put one to Dr. John Swartzberg, the number 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your Corona calls. We'll start with an email sent to coronacalls@kpfa.org. Richard in San Francisco is concerned about the avian influenza that's been moving through our dairy herds. His first question is, does the current flu vaccine offer any protection against bird flu if it manages to spread to humans?
No, it doesn't. At least to the best of our knowledge, it doesn't, and probably, and we don't think it should, because the current vaccine covers H1N1 and H3N2 influenza viruses. Now, the N1 that's covered in the influenza vaccine may cover the N1 seen in the H5N1 avian influenza. Will we get any protection from that? We don't know, but we certainly can't count on that. There is a vaccine that the government has produced that is directed against H5N1. There's not a lot of it, and there's not an enormous push to produce a lot of it. There is a push to produce more of it, but there's not an enormous push to produce a lot of it, and that's disconcerting. And we don't know whether the particular vaccine that we have stockpiled, whether that will cover these particular subvariants of H5N1. So we have lots of question marks and very little answer. And for Richard's question, the current flu vaccine will not help against that. But let me just emphasize now, please get the flu vaccine. It's available for everybody 6 months of age and older. And it will help you prevent getting flu. And if you get flu, it will help ameliorate your symptoms, make you less sick. So it's really worth getting that. And looking at the number of people getting the flu vaccine, it's really below what we should have.
What would be the utility of having a relatively small stockpile of a vaccine against a prospective infectious disease threat? Like, is the idea you want enough to inoculate the medical workers if there's an epidemic?
Right. Well, again, if the vaccine that we've stockpiled works, and that's a big if, we would have enough to start the process of vaccinating healthcare workers. But what I understand is we don't have a large supply of this. There would be, I think, if H5N1 exploded, which we see no evidence of at this point, but if it did, it likely would carry a significant mortality rate, higher than what we see with the routine influenza. If that occurred, the vaccine that we currently have, even if it worked, would not make a big dent in the pandemic, at least for the start.
All right. Second question from Richard is, in reference to what we discussed last week, which is a recall of raw milk products that have tested positive for bird flu here in California. He asks, should the same caution we apply to raw milk be applied to cheese made from raw milk?
We haven't found it in cheese itself, but raw milk, cheese made from raw milk that is not aged could be problematic. We don't know for sure, but it hasn't been found. Certainly, we found it in large numbers in raw milk itself. And that's where right now our concern is. Our concern has not been centered around cheese. So I think the risk would be low, but we don't have as much data as we'd like.
All right. Let's roll through some phone calls with the 7 minutes we have left, starting with Sherry in San Francisco. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning. Dr. Schwartzberg, I got my booster a week ago, and I had such a strong reaction that in the middle of the night I woke up and I was really achy and feeling very weak. And so I got up and I took an ibuprofen finally, and which cut off my negative reaction immediately. But then I was wondering if the ibuprofen might have a diluting impact on the booster. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thanks, Sherry. That's an important question that we really spent a long time addressing early in the pandemic, because people were worried, is it safe to take aspirin or another non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like ibuprofen or naproxen, naperson? Would that blunt the immune response? And there's not much data to suggest it does. Probably it's not wise to take it prophylactically, that is to take an ibuprofen before you get the shot. There was some data to suggest that might blunt the immune response, but taking it like you did afterwards, one dose of ibuprofen, I would not worry that you lost any immunity because you did that. And certainly it gained you, hopefully, some sleep.
All right, next we'll go to Jane, who is here in Berkeley. Good morning, Jane.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My son's in his 40s, early 40s, and he's had a cough for over a month, and I'm wondering what the symptoms are of the respiratory virus and what can be done if it is that.
Jane, sure. Did your son's cough start with like a cold or something that seemed like a normal winter illness?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure now.
Dr. Schwartzberg?
Jane, we're seeing an awful lot of that right now, and it's not surprising because once kids go back to school, we see lots of respiratory viruses circulating. Ryan and I were talking about RSV and influenza and COVID, but there are a lot more respiratory viruses that cause the common cold symptoms, sore throat, nasal congestion, maybe eyes red. And a lot of those viruses will cause a cough. Typically, you don't bring up a lot of stuff with a cough. It's just a very irritating cough. It's not surprising that somebody has several weeks of a cough after a respiratory viral infection. Really, most any of these viruses can do that. The ones that cause just the common cold, like rhinoviruses, typically don't, but they can. But some of these other ones certainly can. So it's possible he could have had RSV or influenza or COVID that's caused the persistent cough, but it's also possible that it was just one of these other viruses. I wouldn't be real concerned if the cough has persisted a month, as long as he doesn't have any other symptoms attendant with it, like bringing up lots of phlegm with the cough. He should get checked for that. If the cough's getting worse, not better, he should get checked for that reason. But otherwise, this is not that unusual.
Dr. Schwartzberg, mild viral infection can produce a secondary bacterial infection. Walking pneumonia is not unheard of after a case of the common cold or influenza or something like that. I was reading in your local epidemiologist newsletter that cases of walking pneumonia, mycoplasma pneumonia, are about 10 times higher this year than they were last year. Is there anything practical that people should be aware of with that?
There is. Walking pneumonia is a term that's been used for well over 100 years, and it's stuck with us. It's not a great term. It just means you have a pneumonia that's not so severe that it throws you into the bed. You don't feel well, you're coughing, but it's persistent, but you're still well enough to carry out many of your daily activities. Mycoplasma pneumoniae is a bacterium, not a virus, and it is notorious for causing walking pneumonia, particularly in younger people. Kids, teenagers, and young adults seem to get this more than other age groups, but it can affect any particular age group. It can be treated with antibiotics. It's very susceptible to tetracyclines and erythromycin and the different drugs that are similar to erythromycin. So we have good drugs that work against it. If you're sick, you're coughing, you're not getting better, certainly if you're coughing and bringing up a lot of stuff, you should get your lungs listened to. If your doctor hears something in your lungs, an x-ray would be appropriate. And if it shows evidence of a pneumonia, then perhaps being on antibiotics would be appropriate at that point. But
what would be your threshold? Like, how long would you be coughing before you went to see your doctor, Dr. Schwartzberg?
It depends how bad it is. If the cough is getting worse after 5 to 7 days, as opposed to getting better, if the cough is productive of lots of stuff after a few days, and seems to be getting worse, get checked at that time. Certainly, if you have fever at any time, that is temperature greater than 100, attendant with the infection. And COVID and influenza and RSV have been ruled out, certainly should be checked as well. So you have to use your judgment. If you're not doing well and it's just been a few days, check in with your physician. It may be worth a quick office visit to get a listen. And again, if that shows anything, to get an x-ray and see what's going on.
All right. We'll leave it there for this week. Thank you for checking in with us, Dr. Schwartzberg.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.